Hello and welcome. This is the Watson Weekend. I'm Rick Watson.
Hi, it's Jessica Laseski. It's another Friday. We are here to call retail's bluff with a smirk and a spreadsheet.
Spreadsheet? No one told me.
I know.
Each week, we untangle the mess behind the headlines, from warehouse walkouts to boardroom flameouts.
You got to think of this as retail therapy for your newsfeed. NBA level insight with barroom level honesty. We almost believe our own BS.
I think most of the time we do.
Yeah, we do. That's why we're here. Why else would we be here?
Exactly. At
least, you might have one or two people that believe it too. I don't know.
Yeah. Welcome back to North Carolina, Jess.
Thank you. Yes. I'm so happy to be back. Back in the land of what temperature is it? Is it summer? Is it winter? Is it fall? We don't know. Our seasons are becoming shorter and shorter. But hey, we're here. And you know what? We wouldn't be here without our great sponsors. So Rick, why don't you tell who brings this fine program to the world today?
Oh, what a professional transition. Mm-hmm. We are sponsored by Rithm. Costs are up, customers are unpredictable, and AI is moving at warp speed. But Rithm's new survey says actually the real threat isn't tariffs or inflation, it's your own internal drag. Really slow processes and messy data are actually what's holding brands back, and they have a study. If you want the playbook for speed and agility in 2026, grab it now at rithm.com/ready. That's rithm.com/ready.
Very good.
That's all I got.
Well, look, I feel that messy data. It feel like it plagues every place I'm at or have been. So I don't know if it's me or if it's them, but you know, data is a mess.
Messy data or bad hair day, you decide.
Well, I actually washed my hair today. This is like no dry shampoo. It's like a fresh wash. So
it's an upgrade. It's an upgrade.
I worked hard on this, Rick. Come on. Right. Now. All right. Well, we have got, as usual, a lot of headlines to unpack. It was a very busy week in retail. Mm. So let's head over to the headline hangover and see what's up.
Oh, we kick off our headline and hangover with our old friends, Jeffy Jeff from Amazon. As you recall, the headline hangover is we actually play a little bit of a guessing game between Jess and I. We have not seen the full headlines. And Jess gets to guess the words that are covered up. The headline is Amazon to pay $2.5 billion for allegedly duping millions to sign up for blank.
I know this. Prime.
Ugh. I mean, even Jeff's laughing at us.
Yes, he is. and he's laughing at this lawsuit.
First of all, this is a ridiculous lawsuit. It was, I think, started under Lena Khan. Now Lena, she go bye-bye. She's open to work on LinkedIn.
She hung up her. And she's hanging up shingles right now.
By the way, did you know that Amazon makes $2.5 billion every 33 hours? This fine means a big fat zero. Meanwhile, I think everyone knows there actually are dark patterns on Amazon. If you aren't subscribed for Prime, you are more than likely to click on something that will automatically sign you up and tell them what they won. If you actually are a consumer that were just duped by this fraud, keep in mind, Amazon Prime costs $139 a year. What do you think that the victims can get back?
I'm going to say something in the range of like $5 to $10.
$51, Jess. Oh, so man. It's a little bit better than
a little bit better.
Nothing. But yeah.
Does Garish qualify for this? Like,
I think he was the only one duped, so he's hoping to be a billionaire.
He's the only lone holdout. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is an interesting one. It has been on lots of, it's made its morning news show rounds as well. So I think they're going to at least have a lot of curious cats to seeing who qualifies.
Yes.
If anything, it's going to drive some traffic to their site and people are going to buy some lightning deals.
Yeah. And look, Kaplan is in the background, the peanut gallery. He wants his Prime refund. You rely too much on Prime, Mr. Kaplan.
Yeah, you got to diversify. Instacart, here you come.
Yes.
All right.
Love it.
All right. So
point for Jess.
Point for me. I'm up next. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, audience. I really appreciate that. All right. So ChatGPT is now 20% of Walmart's what? While Amazon is warding off the AI shopping agents.
ChatGPT is 20% of Walmart's referral traffic.
You're so good. Yes. Yes. This is exactly what the people were looking for.
I love it.
And, you know, we've been talking about this. AI has been crashing the retail party. In August, 20% of Walmart's referral traffic came straight from their friends at ChatGPT. That's up 15% in a month. Etsy's in the mix. They also had 20%. Mm. Target's at 15%. eBay's getting some share.
Was eBay. Yeah. Still around.
Still kicking it, you know? So look, if people were like, hey, what were these sneakers that were like available in 1975? They found them on eBay. But look, overall referrals are still less than 5% of total visits. Amazon's got a bit of a different playbook. As you know, they were like, we're bot free since 93. Yeah. they want to protect their assets. Traffic fell from 18% to 3%. So very different strategy there. We'll have to see, you know, is today's gold rush tomorrow's toll booth?
No bot for you.
Yeah, no bot for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have seen also these inklings, right, that ChatGPT's got some stuff going on. They kind of leaked. Maybe it's leaked. I don't know. When they were talking about the new persona profiles, you could see an orders tab on Sam Altman's screenshot, right? So, I mean, we've been talking about this, like what's the territory they're etching into? Supposedly they also hung out a posting for someone who can help them monetize the business, AKA Think Ads. So it was only a matter of time. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Amazon.
Nothing is free.
Yeah. Nothing's free. Walmart. I don't think you can buy through bots on Walmart. But I do think they're in ChatGPT. So
So and supposedly, Rick, you know, it's 50 million shopping queries on ChatGPT every day.
Mm, that's a big number.
It's a big number. It's not a B yet, but it's a big M.
Yes, exactly. Our next item for you. Hopefully, we can stump the wizard here. Sephora, speaking of affiliates, creators, all the things that we're going to talk about in the show today, preview, Sephora cozes up to beauty creators with new blank.
Sephora is cozing up to new beauty creators with new, is it promotions?
We need like an X or something.
Affiliate program.
Sound.
I was gonna say
affiliate program.
I feel like that's a tangential thing. Come on, guys.
Yeah. So they have partnered with a company called Moton, which specializes in creator affiliate platforms. They are trying to move away or bypass popular affiliate platforms like Impact, Radius, ShopMy, LTK, and move these people onto their own website. Get off of these people where we need to pay for the referral fee.
Right,
get onto our website.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, look, digital commerce is a big deal for beauty. Commerce is actually 50% penetrated in the beauty category in retail globally. And so affiliates and influencers and creators are a big part of this. So I'm sorry, my friend. It's affiliate program.
You have a point. I feel it. I can feel it coming, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. So here's, I think this is super interesting. You mentioned like the power of creators in beauty. We have on Kristen Wiley on the show that we're going to release today. So also very tangential to this topic because beauty is one of the top categories that they're seeing at Statosphere. And it's not surprising that Sephora would want to really own more of not only the discussion and the narrative, but like you said, cut out the fees that they're having to pay because it's such a big program for them. I mean, so many people are influenced by beauty creators and what they see on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube and all of these tutorials. So why not really take control of that ecosystem for themselves? It makes a ton of sense.
Yep. That is what they're up to. And look, Sephora is on a roll. Obviously, it's a very friendly platform for all the socials. And so just trying to keep it all in-house.
Yeah. Keep it in the fam. Okay. So we've got, I'm going to bring us home. Meta is in talks with Google to use Gemini to improve what?
Mark Zuckerberg's hairstyle?
Ad efforts.
Oh.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is big. So look, you know, I don't think anything, any collaboration since like peanut butter and jelly has been this big, right? Like two things coming together. You had Nike and Skims, Jay-Z and Linkin Park. I mean, Meta teaming up with Google. This is really big.
That's a good one.
You know, reports that are saying that Meta's in talks with Google Cloud to tap into Gemini, really to sharpen their ad targeting. You know, yes, Meta is spending billions on building its own AI, but they're hoping to borrow some brains from some of the best in the business, which I think is pretty interesting. Here's like what they want to do. They want to fine tune Gemini on Meta's massive ad data trove, have better targeting, ultimately to get more ad dollars. I don't know, Rick, what are you thinking about this? Is this like the two brains, best minds coming together in the ad business, or is
it's
very kind of road or like entryway into Meta's broader ad strategy?
It's kind of fascinating because usually you don't see kind of number one and number two collaborate like this. They're mortal enemies, but I'm wondering if this is somewhat of a, either an admission that sort of Meta's open source Llama model isn't like, doesn't have a really a consumer face to it. And so it needs to work with Gemini that is a lot more consumer facing and trying to hedge their bets against OpenAI and ChatGPT, who is getting into the ad business. So maybe it's like a frenemy situation. So
maybe
that's what I got for you right now. I completely missed the headline. So I'm probably not the person to listen to on this one.
Hey, look, it's okay. You know, I mean, it is kind of hard to believe. It's almost like a world where Coke and Pepsi are coming together to share a soda fountain. Like, this is big. So
to fight against Dr. Pepper.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, no ink is dry. No contract has been signed.
Okay.
This is definitely one to watch. And, see if like these are just some talks that got leaked or magic's really going to happen here.
Got it. I will keep looking for the ink to dry on the agreement. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I know. So, okay. Well, it looks, I guess we tied, although I still feel like I get the half point. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like you won that one, really.
Yeah. But look, we are going to now get to the next part of our program, which is really why you came to watch. And it is to introduce Kristen Wiley. She's so impressive. I'm really excited to have this this interview released. She's the founder and CEO of Statusphere. It's a platform that helps brands generate thousands of high-performing influencer posts without all the manual work. She's a former creator herself, longtime influencer marketing expert. She built this to really eliminate the friction that marketers face when they're trying to scale with a lot of the micro influencers, which we know really are the ones that have the closest relationship to their influencers. They really do have a lot of pull, but it's hard to manage those in a onesie-twosie way if you're a brand and doing it yourself. And so she really sees this opportunity. They use her, brands today are using her platform. They get guaranteed posts, instant usage rights. They complete campaign execution, all powered by AI and first-party data. And her mission really is to build the influencer creator platform that every marketer wishes they had, and one that actually does work. And it works because of the relationships that she builds with these creators and looking at this from a creator point of view. So really embracing that two-sided marketplace and making sure there's value for brands and creators at the same time. So we're really excited to have this this interview roll. And Rick, anything else you want to add here?
No, she's just so impressive as an entrepreneur, how she's approached building the business. It's already on fire. This the idea of being a community first brand and really being on the ground with people who actually love your product and trying to get your product into more hands is super exciting. I think there's so many brands going to learn from this strategy. We're definitely going to be talking about this in future episodes, as well as at NRF. We're going to host another event this year. And so you and I are going to be there.
Yes, we will. Wouldn't miss it. So in the words of Jay-Z and Linkin Park, this is one you're going to want an encore and more. Let's roll it.
Hello and welcome. We are here with Kristen Wiley, who's the founder and CEO of Statusphere, which is a platform that helps brands generate thousands of high-performing influencer posts without manual work. She built the company as a former creator and longtime influencer marketing expert. And so Jess and I are super excited to welcome Kristen to the show.
Awesome. Yay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited you're here. I think what you have built is no short of amazing. And so I guess I'd love to just start with what gave you this idea and what was your aha moment that was like, I think I've got something here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess like looking back, you know how they always say like entrepreneurs had a lot of businesses growing up. I was one of those kids where I had a lot of businesses growing up, but I never really thought I'd be an entrepreneur. I actually really wanted to be a marketer, which is like a bizarre thing to want as like a fifth grader. But like, there's literally videos of me making advertisements when I was like in fifth and sixth grade. Like I've always like known I want to be in advertising and marketing.
That's so funny.
So you were the meme that's like, I dream of sending emails and having long board meetings when I was little.
Exactly. No, yeah. I am that meme. And I, of course, thought at that time when I was in fifth grade, like social media wasn't the thing, you know, the internet was just coming out, like all of those different pieces. So I didn't know what marketing was going to be. And I never thought I would have this career. But I always knew I loved this concept of like influencing people and really helping people match with a product that fits what their pain point is. My whole family would make fun of me for it. But yeah, that was my background. So when I went to college for advertising and public relations degree. While I was in college, my first class of college, my professor said, you're not going to learn anything in school. You're going to learn it outside of school. Go start a blog. You'll learn more doing that than you will in school. And this is in 2010.
Wow.
So I went home that night and I started a blog and I was like, sure, this seems fun. I remember in high school, I dabbled with it a little bit and I was like, he's like, you'll learn SEO, you'll learn all these things. And he was right. Fast forward a couple years in college, I started getting brand deals where brands would reach out to me to do collaborations. It was like food brands, baking brands. I was like a crafting blogger.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And so that's really what plopped me into this category that I wasn't really expecting. Because when I did graduate college, my first job, they did not care about my degree. They were like, the blog, that's what we want. We want you to manage our blogger network, specifically our mommy blogger network is what my first job was. So it was wrangling those mommy bloggers, getting them to post. And this started in like 2012, 2013 time period. I was like an intern and then went full time with it. And then I just went and I worked from agency to agency, working with different like brands and agencies to help build out their influencer program, which was their blogger program. And bloggers turned into YouTube, turned into Instagram, turned into TikTok. Yeah. And I just like have seen the evolution from both a creator perspective and a brand perspective, which I think is what's helped me have a unique perspective and see this like hole in the space for finding a platform that scales specifically the micro influencer category.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the most difficult group to wrangle. Right. And, there's so many questions I think to unpack there, but kind of staying on this theme of your background and how you got started and the space that you're playing in, is there like a learning that you had in the very early days that you're like, oh man, if I could go back and kind of wave a magic wand and fix one thing, advice for the future entrepreneurs, like what would that be as you were like growing and scaling the business?
I think that my biggest like breakthrough moment was when I realized that no one knows what they're doing. That was my biggest breakthrough. I have people ask me this sometimes. And I'm like, I was always so afraid that I'd like ask the wrong question or that everyone else had it figured out or that I would ask something stupid or I needed a lawyer. And then I just realized like no one really knows what they're doing. So as soon as that like weight lifted, I think that was actually the catalyst.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We've been doing this podcast for almost 2 years. We still don't know what we're doing.
Zero clues.
Exactly. Exactly. So you just kind of go with it.
Yeah, we do. We do.
You said you scaled slowly. Do you consider that a good thing? I mean, some people say like, oh, I'm so successful, but I'm a 10-year overnight success. Is it kind of like one of those things, or how do you think about that idea of fast growth versus slow growth?
Yeah. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I think you always want things to happen faster. So you always want them to happen faster. And it's always like a perspective. Some people will be like, wow, you grow this so fast. I'm like, this has not been fast for me on my side. I've wanted it to be way faster. But I think when you're building especially a platform and a marketplace, you have to be really strategic about how you build it. And I, after using a lot of the other influencer marketing platforms, I think that's actually one of the reasons why a lot of them haven't succeeded. Like there's a lot of, as the investor say, there's like so many dead bodies in the influencer marketing space. Like there's so many. And I think it's my hypothesis is two reasons. One is very few come from the creator side. So they don't understand that like culture and how to talk to the creators or influencers. And you'll also notice I'll use creator and influencer interchangeably because actually creators don't like to be called influencers, but marketers still call them influencers.
I'm guilty. Yeah.
Well, we actually speak to, we have two different audiences. So we speak to them differently. We say influencer marketing to our brands and we say creators to our creators.
Yeah.
So like just little things like that, that I think are end up being very important. And then to your question about growing it slowly, when you're building a marketplace and our goal and my goal from the very beginning was like, I want a platform that can activate thousands of people posting at once. Like, I believe that if we can build a platform that can get 10,000 people posting in 30 days, that's like as much impact or more than a Super Bowl ad, right? But we couldn't just do that out the gate. So we had to build slowly. We had to first get the right creators. And we also had to build slowly with the brands we went after. Because if we went after every brand, then our creators would have lulls in what type of content that they, maybe if it's like, if you did food and beauty in the beginning, well, you have to divide your sales team, right? Yeah. So we had to be really strategic about how we built the platform. And we did start actually more in that like mom influencer category, because that's what I knew and I had a background in. And then moms influence like majority of buying decisions. Right.
So much care of wallet. We control, yes.
Exactly, exactly. So I started there and then we built out from it. Now we do, you know, everything from like food, lifestyle, health and wellness to male creators as well. We actually started mainly female and then slowly branched out because I didn't want to just give them one opportunity and then it go away. Yeah. So we've been very strategic about that. And unfortunately, that just takes time. It's very hard to do very quickly.
Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like you care so much about that creator experience and the value that you're creating for them. You know, marketplaces are two-sided, right? There's got to be value on the brand side. There has to be value on the creator side. And a lot of times, I think in marketplaces, people or those marketplaces will focus on who ends up paying them, right? Not so much on the whether it's the sellers or in your case, the creators. So how have you been able, especially at scale, to create what feels like a really strong community of people who are at the ready to go out and promote these brands? How have you been able to do that with so many thousands and thousands of creators?
Yeah. And that was something that I was like very passionate about from the beginning. And like I said, one of the holes I felt like the other influencer platforms didn't fill is they didn't have that creator experience. So I was on a lot of the other platforms as a creator. And I'll just give you an example. I was a food, baking, crafting blogger. I would get pitched mattress companies. I would get pitched stuff that had nothing to do with what I posted about. And I was like, this seems so silly. And I had like vegan blogger friends that would get pitched beef jerky. It was like, no one's even looking, like, why am I even filling out this profile if no one's going to look at it?
Right.
So from the beginning, that was also my thesis is like, if we can also give creators this consistent stream of great products that they actually want and put like the power back in their hands, it would work out better. So that being said, the only reason we've gotten to where we've gotten is by the amazing team that we have now. Our entire, what we call creator support team, they're all creators. Actually, a lot of them, most of them are like started as creators in our network and some even grew to become that. So they really understand the creator experience. So really, I think that's what has built the community is having a team that understands creators very, very well on that side.
It's so rare. Like what? Your whole support is an AI? I mean, I thought that was the thing now. Having people who know what they're talking about, giving answers to your customers seems like a really, really important idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great because AI can really make it faster. But I think that the human touch, and I know we may get into this too, because I think, you know, AI influencers, all of this, I just think that the human touch is going to become more and more valuable. And I think AI is amazing. And we're using AI in so many ways to automate our softwares, our systems. Like the technology has made so many leaps and bounds on our platform because of it. But I still think that the brands that will succeed are going to understand that human piece. Mm-hmm. And I think that even, you know, human generated content, as I say, is going to be even more important in this like post AI world.
Yeah, I think so. Like the real and the authenticity is what people still crave, right? Rick and I were talking about this before you joined. You know, Vogue got some flack because they had an ad in print and it was a guess ad, and the model was AI generated. And so it is this very weird time of who do you want ultimately selling your products and who do you trust?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I saw that as well. And I do think people are going to have strong reactions if they feel like a fake person is selling them something. Now, I do think there are places where it's going to be great. Maybe you can see what something looks like on you or something like that. But as long as it's very upfront that you know that what you're using is AI, I think that's fine. I think where it's going to get really tricky for brands and where they're going to get in hot water is if they, you know, run an ad and people don't know it, and then they're making buying decisions. It's really like false advertising in a way. Because it's not a human. Especially we have a lot of beauty clients. I mean, imagine if you have someone advertising a foundation or a skin cream and they don't have skin. Like it's clearly doesn't make your consumer feel great.
No, so that's like something that I personally don't think could go to sleep at night. If it's like, oh, I've got all these AI generated people trying to sell my skincare line that actually will never, ever, ever wear it or put it on. One of your claim to fame is this, like you talk about how you can get people organized really fast or your creators organized really fast. You have 1,000 creators posting in less than an hour of setup time. You talked about the 10,000 people posting or talking about a brand can create a much higher ripple effect than even a Super Bowl ad. How do you manage that at scale, where on the brand side, because I've you know, experienced this and gone through this before, where you're like, oh, but I don't know who these people are, so how can I trust them? So how do you create that trust on the brand side? And then on the flip side, how does it feel personal to that end consumer if so many creators are talking about it? Like, how are you balancing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think first on the brand side, I did feel like we had to make a bet early on. Mm. So when I started the company and when I really had I got the idea for the company around 2016. I didn't do anything about it for a while because I actually really did love my job. And it wasn't like one of those where I like, I loved my job. I loved my boss. Yeah. I was like, this is great. But then I had this pull and I was like, if somebody else builds this and I don't, I'm going to be so
mad,
so mad. And that's what really triggered me to start it on that side of things. But when I was on the brand side or the agency side selling this, brand safety, especially with big brands, was a huge issue. Mm. A lot of them were like, we want to approve every single creator. Yeah. You know, we want to do this. But I just felt like where the puck was heading was to these micro influencers. Mm-hmm. And I could see that in the data, that ROI was higher, all of these different pieces. And I was like, if we could build a technology where brands could feel confident that we could vet them, I actually think it's a lower risk for brands, which I think some lawyers and brands are noticing. Because think about it, if you get some big celebrity and that celebrity all of a sudden does something not good, like you just put all your eggs in one basket. If you worked with a micro, I think it's a lot more forgiving. It's like, okay, you didn't, first of all, you're not paying them that much. And it's you know, it's not as big of a deal as like the face of your company doing something like that. So there was that piece. And I just felt like that's where it was heading. And really, I would say in 2020, 2021 is when I saw the shift where I used to have to sell and convince people to use micro influencers and show them the data and show them the ROI. And then right around 2020, 2021 was when brands started saying, no, we don't want the big ones. We want the small ones. Mm-hmm. And then the next problem that came about was, okay, how do we deal with our legal teams? Because if we're going to do 1,000 people posting, I can't have my legal team approve 1,000 posts. No. So luckily we had, because we had taken steps building this technology, that's what we were building for. Mm. So right when we hit that threshold where we could do campaigns with over 1,000 creators, it was because we built the technology to do the reviewing every single post, to look at the objective content requirements. So our technology actually reviews the post, make sure that everything was followed, gives the creator feedback if it's not, if they need to repost, and does all those different pieces, which is why the large brands do feel confident. And I just think the large brands had to change because they're realizing that their lunch is getting eaten by these little nimble brands that that don't have all the have to review every single post manually. So that's where I think we've really found our sweet spot is with these enterprise brands that need, you know, brand safe content at scale.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's fascinating because if the puck is moving, these larger brands, they're not even familiar with this category and they're not investing enough behind it. From a marketing mix perspective, what are you seeing from an allocation? Like if you're a marketing director from between like paid influencers versus, you know, own content and things like that?
Yeah, great question. The interesting part is how much they're woven together. And actually, the biggest opportunity typically for large brands is that their organizations aren't set up in a way to maximize the ROI, in my opinion. So to answer your question, you know, you get a piece of content, influencer content, 1,000 pieces on Statusphere. Great. You get all the buzz, the social SEO lift. There's like a bunch of things that you, benefits you get from all this content, but you could get even more benefits if you just pulled your ads team in and sparked some of the content, allow listed some of the content, a huge ROI, actually. Like we, I just had a brand the other day tell us they were seeing 5X their return, their ROAS on content from Statusphere versus what they were using before. But if that brand didn't connect their ads team to it, they would have never seen that. So that's why it can be also a complicated question of like what's, what spend is being pulled. We have another client that it was really interesting. They started by pulling their like PR budget. Then all of a sudden we started seeing, they're like, we're now pulling our ads budget into this because this is content for our ads. Then they're like, we're going to pull our retail support budget, which is like, you know, sending creators into Target and to Whole Foods and into different places. So we're noticing that it depends on how the organization starts using our product, but we end up pulling from a lot. And I think that's true just with influencer marketing as a whole. But I do think that the organizations of the future are going to reorg their marketing departments to really have more of that cross-departmental combination so that you can actually get the maximum ROI across it. But it, that's why it's been interesting to see where the budgets are pulled from. Then there's like digital budget. And then there's like, sometimes we'll get the social budget. And so it really depends on what the goal is of the company at the time. But overall, we are seeing budgets just shift to need this channel. And I do believe it is a channel part of your multi-channel strategy and just making sure you maximize it to its full potential.
No, it has to be because and I think that it's interesting, depending on the way that you activate these creators, it could be top of funnel, it could be mid funnel, it could be bottom, depending on like how you do that. So do you approach the campaigns differently or based on what the brand goals are? Do you try to mix it in both? Or do you say like, look, our lane is here and we just, we kind of try to stay in one area?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're a technology platform. So I like to say we're a car and you can drive it wherever you want to go, right? We can give you some roadmaps. And that's what our customer success team does, is they give you roadmaps of how to use the platform properly. But overall, our campaign types within the software, we have four main campaign types. It's brand awareness. So you just want to optimize for as many eyeballs as possible. We have repurposable content, which is like you want to optimize to get content for ads. We have one that's social SEO. So you want to optimize to increase your social search. And then the last one is retail support. So you want to optimize based on geo-targeting and all those pieces as well. So brands can actually leverage it in different ways. But I really love how you were saying that you can use it in each piece of the funnel, because I see brands do that all the time, especially on the social SEO side. It's like, we want to go after key terms that are top of funnel, mid funnel, and then bottom funnel, because we have to get the whole buyer's journey, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that you can't get all those messages into one. And that's where a lot of brands fail sometimes, because you're trying to pack it all in. And especially if you're on a new product launch and you want to get every single detail, and you might have to start top and then, you know, carry someone through. I mean, you can utilize creator voices or creator experiences to help you do that. So I love how you've thought about that part of the journey and then created these different campaign types to make all that happen. It's super interesting.
Yeah. And I think in marketing, when we're talking about like attribution, you're people are pulling in all these budgets, it sounds like proactively in some respects and sort of surprising ways. How do your customers think about attribution for these influencers, and how, like, what tools are they using to model that? Is that something you help connect them with? Are those partners of yours? Those sorts of things.
Yeah. So attribution's the holy grail of marketing. And yes. Ultimately, I would love to be able to be part of helping brands, you know, crack that nut of attribution.
Right.
I mean, we all know when the cookies went away, that got a lot harder too. Mm-hmm. So we've all been, I feel like, in an uphill battle for a bit about it. I do think that there's going to be better solutions moving forward. So to answer like high level, it's very hard to track influencer attribution. In ads, it's great. So like that's mm-hmm. how a lot of our brands sure. do it. They're like, okay, we saw that 5x lift. When it comes to just the consumer's journey, we know they search on TikTok, they see it, they open up Google, they search. So we actually will see brands monitor like their Google search for the keywords they're going after mm-hmm. And their TikTok search as well. And they'll see that it goes up significant amounts. So we've had multiple brands when they run these campaigns mm-hmm. see that lift. So although we can't track all the way down to the click exactly, like, yes, you could put an affiliate link. Yes, you can do that. It's just the consumer just doesn't shop that way, right? They need like multiple touches and you're yeah. pulling them through the funnel. So I would say most of our brands have a very specific lens of how they look at that ROI. Ultimately, it is sales that they want to see, which sometimes it's great. They happen to just be doing mm-hmm. A campaign on Statusphere, and they will see sales lift in retail yeah. or something like that. But at the end of the day, realistically, we're part of a multi-channel approach mm-hmm. and seeing that incremental lift. I have spoken with some of the different softwares and platforms and companies that help with that mm-hmm. with large brands. So we're looking to possibly integrate with one of those to really help them, because they actually came to us and they were like, influencer is our hardest thing to track. Like
yeah.
we want to figure this out. So we are partnering with them to see how we can help show that for brands, because people mm-hmm. know it works. They can see it when they stop it, it slows down, but it's just so hard to get the two together. So yeah. that is something that I would love to crack that.
Yeah. yeah. And everyone has a finance team and a CFO that's saying, mm-hmm. show me the money or show me the ROAS, right? So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Look, it sounds like you've already you've solved the worst problem, which is like the holdout testing. People stop it and you're like, well, my sales dropped or my traffic stopped or both, or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been lucky to have a few brands only use us so that they could test some things. I always say, I don't recommend that as a marketer. Like, that goes against everything in marketing to like probably only do one thing, unless you really are just testing mm-hmm. it. Because to maximize your ROI, if you do multiple things, that's just how you're going to maximize it. So that's what I recommend. But we have been lucky enough to have a few brands do that and mm-hmm. really see the incremental lift.
Yeah. I mean, relying on influencers, I mean, there are a lot of sort of, you alluded to it earlier on, they're just sort of nightmare scenario. You think about the Fyre Festival and people doing like, oh, go to this place, and then it turns out to be a disaster. Like, is there a nightmare scenario, or is it in your mind, you wake up every morning, cold sweats, like something's going to happen to one of your brands?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like at this point, I've seen it all because I've been doing it so long. But I think that's also what makes me like not as nervous, because it's like even things that you think are gonna go sideways, you're like, oh, they actually don't. Since building Statusphere, it's been a lot better, because I find that the biggest like Fyre Festival moments typically happen with big creators when you put yeah. all your eggs in that basket. And yeah. we've seen that happen, where all of a sudden they do something that, you know, no one agrees with, or is very yeah. polarizing, or is something like that. And you just paid them all that money, and it's this whole like backup, you know, you have to back up. With micros, I just feel like it just diversifies your risk. So it's yeah. it's not as big on that side. I will say on the brand side, I do see brands sometimes come in hot and want to scale their micro influencers before even really thinking through though their product market fit.
Yeah.
And they try to force product on a market or an audience that doesn't want it. And luckily we so when the offer goes out through mm. our software, it'll show like what we call the claim rate. And it gives that data back to the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And brands do find really interesting insights in that, because it's like if people don't even want to claim your product to get like either for product or to get paid to post about it, like you might want to think about your targeting. Like if you're targeting, we had one brand that was targeting women with curly hair, and none of the women with curly hair wanted the product because the product had an ingredient that they didn't want. So the brand did learn from it. But I think like brands could also learn a lot by like, I always say, we're going to put, it's like pouring gas on a fire with Statosphere. So you better know what you want, who you want to reach.
Yeah.
Luckily that we give the creators the opportunity to give that feedback. It's not they're going out and bashing the brand, but I think, you know, if you want to maximize your spend, like really nail that piece to the product, but then that's when the magic happens. You have a product that's amazing. We see it like, you know, just the word of mouth, like wheel just start rolling when they start using Statosphere. Yeah.
That's huge. So it sounds like you've got so much data that you're passing to brands that can be invaluable and help them either sharpen their campaigns or think about their product market fit. On the creator side, is there data you're passing to creators to help them as well, just like strengthen their ability to either get more deals with brands or have more success in their the way that they're posting or going to market or talking about brands? Just curious if there's like a part of that two-sided marketplace, are you passing data back to?
Yeah. Great question. So my team is actually very passionate about this. They have like a whole plan and you can tell because it's coming from because they're creators themselves of like how they want to help that audience. And so we have a big plan to roll out even more, but right now a lot of the education we do is both in the app and on our social channels, which are very active. Thanks to, I have to give credit to our team for an incredible job on that. So most of our social channels are very educational of like how to shoot content, how to get brand deals, how to make sure that like maximize your chance of a brand picking yours to spark the content. Cause in our platform, the brand or the creator sets their rate for the brand to spark the content. That was an educational piece altogether. For example, this is one way we use data with the creators is we let them know what like the going rate for a spark ad is because micro influencers, a lot of them don't know even what a spark ad is or that they should be charging. They just were giving it to brands. And we knew like brands will pay a pretty penny for that because there's a big ROI.
Yeah.
So that's been really cool to see the creators making incrementally more through Statosphere as we've educated them on, hey, you don't need to just give that away. Here's the going rate. Like we let them set it. If they want to set it at $0, they can. But just so you know, this is the going rate brands are paying. So most creators are going to pick that rate or higher.
Right. Yeah. That's a, well, and that keeps them engaged too, right? And you know, you're continuing to grow and build this community. And I would assume you also get the benefit of word of mouth among creators too, right?
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful flywheels that it's created. I always tell this story because this is actually why I started the company. I like had the idea for a long time. I told you, I was like, if somebody else does this, I'm going to be mad. I'm like, I want to just build some like test to see if it would work.
Yeah.
So I built a landing page. There was no product, no nothing. I just kind of put the thoughts around it. And I DM'd it to a bunch of creators I didn't know on Instagram, probably like 10. And then I woke up the next day and I had 15 applications. And I was like, I'm building this product. Because they had already shared it in like one day. I was like, because that's how social they are.
So
it really does create a great flywheel on that side.
Oh, that's awesome. I love how scrappy you were in just getting started. Some people would wait, you know, a whole year and build the perfect platform. And it sounds like you started with a landing page and lots of thought, clearly, but you didn't let the whole
tons of experience
get in the way. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, it was very ugly. I mean, I definitely live by that. Like if you're not embarrassed by it, then it's you're launching too late. if you saw the first versions, they were bad, but I also did it out of necessity. So I am a non-technical founder. So I didn't know how to code, but luckily even, you know, back in 2018, there was no code tools that I could play around with. Now they're much better. So I think it'd be amazing if I was doing it now. But even back then, I was like, if they will buy this, imagine what they will buy when, like, how much they'll pay when I actually build the good thing.
Yeah.
When you have the whole thing ready.
Yeah. That's amazing. I think the community is such an interesting story because I think creating a community of essentially some subset of your customers or your ecosystem is what a lot of people are trying to do and fail at it. Your content sounds like a big part of it. You're trying to help these creators succeed, even if they don't use your platform, this content is useful to them. And I think a lot of people miss that. Can you talk a little bit about your community, your vision behind what that would become and is becoming still?
Yeah. And I love the way you articulated that, because that has been a big piece. Being a blogger, starting as a blogger myself, that's what blogging is. Like, you're putting just education out there to educate people, and then hopefully, you know, it's a win-win relationship. And really, it's like inbound marketing at its core, right? Mm. And I've always thought that it just makes a ton of sense to put the content out there and educate your audience and provide them value first before you ask for anything. But we'd be nothing without our creators. So the community is so important. And that's what we also try to tell brands, and really what we want them to do as well through our platform. Like, they can actually build their own sub communities within our platform and engage them in the same ways. So I think that is where I think the next puck is heading is really this community powered commerce, where it's, you're thinking about each brand is thinking about that as a main channel, because otherwise it's just so hard to differentiate in this world, this chaos where you can just whip up a brand and go. Like, building that community is, I think, what's going to make the brands more and more valuable moving forward.
Mm. Yeah. And do you have any weird community stories, like something that maybe you didn't think community could get built around, whether it was, you don't have to say the brand or the product, you can if you want to, but no, not revealing any secrets here, but just like something that people kind of organized and rallied around that you're like, huh, I wouldn't have put that on my bingo card.
Yeah, I have a good one. This is like, so Statusphere, I told you what we focus on. This is actually outside of Statusphere in my like previous lives of another founder friend I have, but I think it'll answer your question well. So he has a platform that goes after, especially I think like plumbers and that category. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge plumber influencer community on YouTube, on social media. There's also like a big like trucker community on TikTok. Like, these micro communities, like if you're going after them, they are so powerful. It's crazy. But he ended up building it to the point where this like community of these like plumbers were so obsessed with his product that like, so I was cool. Like, this is amazing. Right. You know? And I think it just proves like we're all people. Like at the end of the day, I always say like anyone who can influence a buying decision is an influencer. And that is like my thesis. And I just feel like we're finally entering an era in the digital marketing landscape or journey where like now we can make sure we activate these influencers at scale, which is all of us, and really monetize it for brands. And if you get them all together, you can see that impact. But it is really cool to see these like niche communities that come up, and how the internet really brings them together.
Plumber talk, right?
Plumber talk, yeah.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be a podcast if we didn't talk about AI a little bit, like especially these big LLMs that people were saying like, oh, this is how everyone's going to purchase. Clearly, how people buy and how people think about buying, it's going to be still an omni thing, yet these LLMs are going to be an important part of that journey. How do you think about that with regards to Statusphere and your creators?
Yeah, I had a really great conversation with one of our clients the other day. So like really what my role within the company is now is head of product. That's where like I feel like I have the most leverage within the company because I have both of the experiences. So I love talking to our customers and getting their feedback. And I just had a conversation with a large CPG brand earlier this week about this. And the term that everyone's starting to use is like GEO. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's fully sticking, but that's what I'm hearing everyone start to use. And he said something on the call that I thought was like very, very well said. He was like, I don't know if it's GEO because I don't know if it's optimization. I feel like you're more influencing the LLM. I'm like, yeah, they're like a human. Like, that's what's so crazy about them is they are influenced almost the same way humans are influenced.
Sure. Yeah.
And now this brand specifically was bringing this up because they happened to see a lift in LLM traffic from LLMs when they were running a campaign with us. Mm. And we were hypothesizing around it. And we noticed, obviously, the LLMs, especially I know ChatGPT, is like now pulling in Instagram because Instagram is now content and TikTok content is being served in Google. So then the LLMs go search it and they're actually seeing what comes up in Google. So we're like, this is so interesting. I think there's like a whole nother like category, but really at the end of the day, these LLMs want to provide really valuable, valuable answers to humans. So they need humans to get the data to give that. So I feel like there's also a big bet that like, this is also how you're going to influence the LLMs. I mean, we've seen that with Reddit, they're going on Reddit, but now they're starting to pull Instagram and TikTok content, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about the sources of the information, right? To kind of build the story or the narrative. I think that is super interesting. So, Rick, any final questions?
No, I mean, I think this is great. I mean, especially in this AI future, the unique proprietary data, you're creating it from scratch with your platform based on authentic sources. That's so rare. And I think that it kind of bodes well no matter how this ends up, because, I mean, you have OpenAI. I frankly wouldn't be surprised, and maybe you could use this on your own, like OpenAI, like, signs a licensing deal with you for your influencer. You know what I mean? Just because they're paying like $20 million to the New York Times for like made up content half the time. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually, it's so funny you're saying that too. I was literally just thinking about that yesterday after I was marinating on that conversation with that brand. I was just like, it's similar, just like how they're, you know, getting Reddit content or whatever, you know, it really can become this source, especially if we have certified humans that are actually giving the reviews. And I think there's definitely something there. And I do feel like it's just going to become more and more valuable as AI becomes more and more popular.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this
Well, Kristen, what you've built is so impressive. I've loved talking to you and learning about Statusphere, but also just how you're thinking as an entrepreneur. It feels like even though you've got this very well-established business, you keep iterating and building and creating value. And so congrats on what you've built. It's amazing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a fun journey with a great team, but we're very excited for the future. So
yeah, well, it looks pretty bright for you. I think there's these creator opportunities are definitely not going away, especially like you said, we're craving these human experiences. So I look forward to seeing where you guys go in the future.
Thank you.
Following the journey.
Thanks so much for being here, Kristen.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.